welcome back to the program. For almost 60 years, Leonard Bernstein was both one of the world's most gifted conductors and one of our most progressive political voices. Often these two sides of Bernstein were looked at in separation. This morning we're going to talk about both of these. My guest, Barry Selds, has a new biography of Bernstein where he weaves together both the personal, the professional, and the political in a way that gives us a better picture of a true icon of American culture and power. It is my pleasure to be joined this morning by my guest, Barry Selds. He's a professor of political science at Rider University and the author of the new book, Leonard Bernstein, The Political Life of an American Musician. Barry, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure. Glad to be here.
Great to have you here. Talk about when Bernstein first came on the scene in the late 40s.
Okay, what happened was that he had, his obvious gifts were well known to people such as Aaron Copland and Dimitri Metropoulos, Sergei, the conductor of the Boston Symphony. And the result was that he catapulted quickly from graduating from Harvard to Curtis Institute and then to becoming assistant conductor of the New York Philharmonic. And when one day Bruno Walter, who was due to conduct, fell ill, Bernstein was called on, and he showed up at the studio. It was being broadcast by CBS, and he stepped into the role and did a marvelous job. The next day, the New York Times ran an article on this boy wonder whose career was just taking off within a short while. He had his first symphony, Jeremiah, performed by the Boston Symphony. Shortly thereafter, he met Jerome Robbins. This is 1944, and they did Fancy Free, the ballet, and the same year, the great show On the Town. So from then on, Bernstein's name was in the ascendant. He was quickly well-known, and within a year after that, was asked to lead the New York City Symphony Orchestra, which he did under Mayor LaGuardia. So Bernstein took off, his career took off spectacularly in the 1940s.
Mm-hmm. And when were there the first hints, the first noticing of any kind of political views coming from Bernstein?
Okay, back in 1939, let's first of all put the context going here. When he met, first he was himself, of course, being born Jewish in the 30s, made one pretty much a liberal. Roosevelt was the hero of the household. When he entered Harvard, it was Roosevelt's second term. The Nazis were gaining in power. They were in power in Europe. Father Coughlin and others were broadcasting anti-Semitic speeches in America, so that Bernstein was quite aware of the great division between liberalism and reaction around the globe. He met Aaron Copland and others, as I was saying, very quickly. Copland's circles were all very far on the left wing. He hung out at the Group Theater with such people as Ilya Kazan and John Garfield and others. So Bernstein's immediate company, even while he was an undergraduate, was with left-wing people. In 1939, he led a performance of Mark Blitzstein's The Cradle Will Rock, which was the Great New Deal left-wing folk opera.
Mm-hmm.
Without him knowing it, the FBI was now going to begin to record his activities. The first entry into the FBI dossier, I think, is 1940 or 41, which harkens back to a report that Bernstein had been in a communist cell or something along those lines at Harvard.
Mm-hmm. How did Bernstein react to getting caught up in this political maelstrom? How did he feel his political views might impact on his work, especially once his meteoric rise began?
Well, I think that the very first indication he had of anything of repressive sort came in 1946. He had been speaking on behalf of the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee, which had been an organization set up to aid refugees coming especially out of Franco Spain. So these were progressive or left-wing refugees being aided. And of course, as the Cold War got started, the Truman administration put the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee on the Attorney General's list as a communist organization. Bernstein was due to give a talk in San Francisco with Pierre Monteux, the conductor, when he was ordered by his agency to not give the speech. He wrote to his secretary that he thinks this is the beginning, well, this is a kind of I don't know if he used the word fascist, but certainly of a very, very repressive right-wing assault on him. This was the first. In 1948, when Henry Wallace mounted a campaign to restore the New Deal, that was going to be a progressive party campaign to win the presidency, he joined in very rapidly and announced that he was going to write the Great American Opera. And he said this while he was conducting a revival of Blitzstein's Cradle Will Rock, which was an obvious statement in those days of left-wing intent against the assault on the left from the Cold Warriors.
How did he view the Cold War?
He was very hostile toward it. He thought, as most progressives did in those days, that this was a right-wing reaction to end the New Deal at home and to contain the Soviets abroad, but did not see this in the very beginning as a way to stop hostile communism. What he really was arguing, what they were arguing, was that this was an American, capitalistically oriented attack on the Soviet Union. I think it took time for progressives like Bernstein to come to understand that the Soviets were aggressive themselves. But that would come later. Right now, the point is that the attack was on left-wingers, progressives in general, and Bernstein began to feel that attack on himself,
and
especially
when
the progressives lost in 1948.
Right. In feeling that attack on himself, how did he feel that he might separate it or not from his work and from his musical career?
He had wanted, as I said, in 1948 to write that Great American Opera, which would have been more of a, how can I put this in a way that he wanted to do what Blitzstein had done with Cradle Will Rock, but to write a very serious operatic work that would sum up progressive aspirations in that period. He had to drop that immediately. First of all, his audience disappeared. They all voted for Truman. One. Two, the repression set in very, very quickly. And instead of writing that opera, Bernstein turned instead to Auden's The Age of Anxiety, which was Bernstein's second symphony, and the title was quite apt, because from then on, the age was certainly one of anxiety for him.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that from hoping to compose that great American opera to instead writing Age of Anxiety within a year tells us a lot about what was on his mind.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the progression of his work during this early period, aside from the politics, and how his work as a musician, as a conductor, as a composer was progressing.
Okay, as a composer, after Age of Anxiety, he did a few things, but basically began to, like so many did, withdraw from politics. I mean, he had been listed by Life magazine as one of 50 communist dupes, along with people such as Norman Mailer and Arthur Miller, Albert Einstein. In 1950, he was listed by Red Channels as a pro-communist person, which was tantamount in those days to getting oneself blacklisted. And sure enough, CBS blacklisted him in 1950. The State Department blacklisted him in 1950. So Bernstein was in serious trouble in this sense. And his compositions, he didn't do anything politically much from then on. He was, like so many others, under terrible pressure. Meanwhile, friends of his were being called before the Committee on Un-American Activities, the McCarthy Committees, and they were many of them betraying each other, as we know, and Bernstein had to stand by and watch this. He was terrified of being called up himself. He wrote to his sister, Shirley, of his terror of having to appear and hope that he might stand up and say no to the inquisitors. So he was in a terrible shape in those days, fearful of exposure, fearful of having to be brought before the committee, and hopefully not being sent to prison, as so many people had been
mm-hmm.
put up to the committee. So that's what Bernstein's attitude, 1950, 51, 52. He was composing an opera, Trouble in Tahiti, which took on a daring but not politically daring theme, that is, of suburban angst, couples who lived in the city moving to the suburbs hoping for a paradise and finding it to be just the contrary. It was a theme of importance, but not a theme of terribly politically divisive importance.
His reputation as a composer, his talents, and his reputation continued to grow, though, during the period in the late 50s when he wound up, what, it was 57, he was on the cover of Time magazine, sure, and then participated in the groundbreaking of Lincoln Center shortly thereafter.
Right. But the story of how that happened is quite extraordinary. Because Bernstein, as I said, he was blacklisted in 1950-51. He came back to the U.S. From a trip to Europe in January of 1951 and was told by a Hollywood producer who he met on the ship that he would be blacklisted if he tried to get work in Hollywood. So he knew that he was under real repression. In 1953, his passport was revoked. He could not travel abroad. Now, at that moment, the same thing had happened to, among others, Paul Robeson, whose career was being destroyed, in fact, whose life was being destroyed by the revocation of his passport. So Bernstein must have known he was in very, very deep trouble. What did happen, however, was that he hired a lawyer who had been a part of the anti-communist crusade. The lawyer was able to get Bernstein off the hook, so to speak, by having him sign an affidavit in which he took back everything he believed in, promised to go to synagogue in the future, which was one of the rites of passage into Orthodoxy, a number of other such things, promised to vote only Democratic or Republican. The affidavit was kept secret from virtually everyone until now, save for its being passed among the vigilante groups, which were able to restore Bernstein to good grace that he could compose for the On the Waterfront. That was 1953. In 1954, with that affidavit having been circulated about, the Ford Foundation was able to get Bernstein back onto CBS Now and the show Omnibus. Within a year, having been cleared of everything, he was welcomed back to the Philharmonic, the New York Philharmonic. He was assistant director in 1956, 57, co-directing with Metropolis, and 1958, I hope I have my years right now, was now going to become the music director of the New York Philharmonic. And, of course, his career was soaring as well, because in 1956 was Candide, 1957 West Side Story. So all of these were pushing along a career that, as we know, was meteoric. And, of course, then Time magazine, you're right, published his picture on the cover. This is the same organization, Time Life. Life magazine, only a few years before, having printed Bernstein's photo as one of 50 communist dupes. So his resurrection, his restoration into the good graces of Orthodox life were assured by the late 50s.
What were his thoughts in signing that affidavit that you talked about?
He told his brother Burton that it was a ghastly experience, the whole experience of getting his passport back, but didn't elaborate, at least nothing that has been seen in print. And it was something that he never talked about, so far as I can tell, the rest of his life. But it had to sit there as a self-condemning essay. I'm sure that it must have been on his mind, God forbid that this be ever revealed. And it wasn't revealed until now.
How was he successful, or his lawyer successful, in keeping it under wraps? And what were his suspicions at the time, given where he was coming from and how his career was resurrected?
Well, how it was kept under wraps, most extraordinary. I don't have an answer for that. I've wondered about that myself. It never, ever circulated. It never surfaced. I know his lawyers told him that he was circulating, I forget the lawyer's name, was circulating the affidavit amongst those vigilante groups. That's on paper, that's on record. But what happened, how it was received by those groups, how it was kept under wraps, is unknown.
Mm-hmm. Talk about how Bernstein viewed the changes that were taking place in the country as the radical period of the 50s gave way to the 60s.
Well, he, with the election of John Kennedy, who was a friend of his, things turned around extraordinarily for Bernstein. 1960 was a miraculous year, because the year not only that Kennedy was running and won the presidency, but it was the year of the Mahler bicentennial, which had a great, great importance for Bernstein's career. And 1960, Kennedy wins, and immediately Jackie Kennedy and John Kennedy invite Bernstein and his wife Felicia to the White House. They came twice. They stayed over. Bernstein became a regular at Camelot, so to speak. nevertheless, politically, he was still very, very much aware, and he started to come back politically, as so many former radicals did in that era, in the 60s. Third Symphony, Kaddish, is an attack on the firebombing in Europe and the use of atomic weapons, just general anger at warfare. And that became a guiding theme of his all through the period, right through to the time he died. So he became, again, politically active. Once Kennedy came into office, he was enlisted in the civil rights movement. He showed up in Selma at the end, in Montgomery, when the march from Selma to Montgomery took place in 1965. He was already beginning to make anti-war speeches, which he began to do quite regularly in the period 67-68. So he became very active politically once again in the middle to late 60s.
Did his political activism in the 60s with respect to the civil rights movement, the war in Vietnam, etc., did that have an adverse impact on his music, on his creative output?
Oh, I don't think so. Especially in the 60s, he was not, when he was politically active, it certainly did not have a negative effect. The interesting thing is what happens with Mass, because the whole story with his writing Mass says something about where he was able to, how he was able to and not able to get his political views into his music. An interesting moment and contradictory moment in Bernstein's career, the composition of Mass. What happened was this. In 1966, Jackie Kennedy had commissioned Bernstein to write a work that would be used in the opening of the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. That was due to be opened in 1969, but then moved to 1970. So from 1966 on, what he's going to compose is in the back of his mind. In this period, he's starting to make his anti-war speeches. He's especially going after the military-industrial complex, which he said was, as one can imagine, a terrible distortion of American values, which he deplored. In 1969, he begins work seriously on writing Mass. Meanwhile, the year before, Daniel and Philip Berrigan, and Daniel Berrigan's going to figure very heavily in this story, had done their famed act at Catonsville, Maryland. What happened there was that the Berrigans, both of them Roman Catholic priests, Daniel was a Jesuit and Philip a Paulist, I believe. They and a number of other Roman Catholic clerics broke into the draft center at Catonsville, took out some 600 files, and using napalm, lit them on fire, having called a group of reporters to watch this happen. Of course, the police showed up, and the Catonsville group was soon under arrest. On purpose, this was all planned out. That's 1968. Bernstein is very much taken with this event. He's writing Mass, the Berrigans are now in Danbury Prison. In 1970, just before the Mass is going to be produced, Bernstein shows up in the Danbury Penitentiary to visit Berrigan, and had been very moved by Berrigan himself, very moved by the Catonsville play that Berrigan had written, and Berrigan had also produced a sermon from the underground. Berrigan had been on the lam from the police for about a year, showing up here and there and delivering a sermon, which was very, very much one of ethical moment. How does one not take one's stand in the face of catastrophe? How does one not stand up to the Nazis? One must stand up in all these situations. This was very, very meaningful for Bernstein. So Bernstein shows up in Danbury Prison, and Berrigan at one point thought that Bernstein would use that sermon in his Mass, and Berrigan wrote something about what will Nixon think. Now, of course, writing anything in prison will immediately be found by the authorities. J. Edgar Hoover, who had been after Bernstein for decades, and I'll get to that shortly, saw this now as a part of the grand plot that the Berrigans were beginning to develop from prison. The Berrigans, Hoover insisted, plans to kidnap Henry Kissinger and to blow up certain tunnels in Washington, D.C. So here's Bernstein in Caton's in the prison, Danbury, visiting Berrigan, and Hoover saying, "Ah, then Bernstein's going to be part of this plot, and will use mass for the premier as a way to get at Nixon, to embarrass Nixon." Nixon was due to show up for that inaugural evening, for that premier evening. On July 14, Bernstein was refused entry to Danbury. The premiere of Mass took place on September 8, but amazingly enough, nothing of Bernstein's anti-war attitudes, nothing of Berrigan, nothing of that sermon really showed up in Mass, which is why I regard Mass as a failure in this regard. It may have been great music. It was certainly part of the 60s world of such as inhabited by the shows like Hair and such, but it did not have the political import that it might have, given all that Bernstein had done in preparation for it.
Was it another case of Bernstein backing away from controversy as he did when he signed the affidavit? Did he back off from his principles again with respect to Mass?
Well, it's an interesting question. Let's say this, with the affidavit, it was a much different situation. He was facing career closure, or worse. Here, he was a very, very famous man by the late 60s. Why didn't he attack Nixon? Why didn't he do this? Well, first of all, he didn't want to embarrass Jackie Kennedy. The Kennedys had been very, very good to him. Kennedy had bailed him out of a particularly tough moment in 1956 when he was once again going to be called before, this time the Rooney Committee.
Mm-hmm.
So there was that. He wanted to write for posterity, to write a show which would have direct political meaning, might make the piece only a piece for the moment. And therefore, maybe he wanted to move from that. Otherwise, I really can't say. I don't want to do psychoanalysis. I'm afraid to do that. So I really don't want to push that argument too far. But I must say, I remain disappointed with that with Bernstein's failure to locate the center of gravity in that show with the war itself.
Was there a war?
He just complained about the divisiveness of the kids all about him.
Does it appear that they were battles that Bernstein had with himself as to what was more important, his politics or his music?
Right. I think that that's maybe the case. I think there had been built into American thinking for quite some time the idea that the arts really ought not to be political. They had been, of course, terribly political in the 60s, I'm sorry, in the 30s. And I think that later, by the 1980s, Bernstein would once again begin to think about something in which the arts, in which the aesthetic and the political would be synthesized. But it could very well be that there was an animus in American aesthetic life toward anything political. I think this is the case with the in the period after the Second World War, when American literature dropped its being political. You know, we had a very political literature in the 20s and 30s. By the 1940s, especially when the Cold War set in, there was a tremendous divorce between the aesthetic and the political, which remained in force right into the 60s. That there was a synthesis for a while, but then things moved apart again. And in fact, there's a good deal of complaint these days, a lot of discussion these days, about how American literature has failed to be politically aware. And I think that that there's a larger picture here, which Bernstein may be within, which he may be understood.
What happened then with Bernstein in sort of this post-political period after 1974 that you write about, when the civil rights movement was sort of over for the time, when the war in Vietnam was over, when the radicalism of the politics of the time faded away?
Right. This is quite the case. Once the radicalism did disappear, it dissipated and began to disappear altogether, by the early 70s, there was a tremendous feeling on the left of that the great moment of possibility, 1968, had passed. And things fell into disarray. The civil rights movement had fallen apart. The anti-war movement, of course, was gone. The women's movement and the gay movements were left on their own. There were no great mass movements that they had been part of in the 60s. These were now gone. And there was a feeling on the left of dismay. Bernstein retreated, like so many others did, into aesthetics. His Norton lectures in 1973 were pretty much apolitical. But something happened around 1976 that turned this around. In 1976, the American Bicentennial was held, and you remember, those of us who were able to remember it, it was, for the most part, a grand celebratory moment in which a lot of other stuff was shoved under the carpet, so to speak. Well, Bernstein was not going to allow that to happen. 1977, he wrote his Bicentennial work, of course, a year late, Songfest. And Songfest begins with a fanfare, as one might expect from a celebratory piece, except the fanfare is somewhat dissonant, as if critical. And it begins with a poem. The Songfest is a bunch of poems that are set to music. The first poem is one of Frank O'Hara, that O'Hara wrote way back in the 50s, which says, "Let us do something grand," and then it says, "No, something small, something un-American." Now, un-American has two meanings, one of which was less than grandiose. But, of course, the other meaning, for anyone who was living through those times, was un-American refers to the Un-American Activities Committee. So let us do something un-American, as if to attack the committee itself. And Bernstein sets this to music at the very beginning. Among the songs that are set is one of Walt Whitman, which was a poem that he had left out of Leaves of Grass. It's a paean to and a lament about the homosexuality in his life. It's called To What You Said. And it's perhaps, in my estimation, Bernstein's most beautiful song. Bernstein wrote many, many songs. But this lament of Whitman's has an especially important moment, because right in the middle of the lament, Whitman writes the line, "I introduce that new American salute." And at this moment, Bernstein's music has a very harsh, grating sound to it, and anger. So there's an angry moment in Songfest, as well as the bit about the Un-American Activities Committee, Un-Americanism. So Songfest begins to bring Bernstein, by 1977, out of the doldrums that had attacked so many people on the left in those years. So that really represents the one apogee, let's say that, of his career.
In retrospect, to what extent did Bernstein, as a composer, as a musician, live up to the early potential?
As a composer, his greatest worry was that he was not writing that piece, which was going to be signally important to him. On his deathbed, he said the one thing that was so awful for him, so terrible for him, was that he never wrote that great piece. Now, most people will argue, of course he wrote great pieces. West Side Story is a great piece. So many others are great pieces. But for Bernstein, what he wanted to write was not just a great piece, but that great piece. That would be that great American opera, but now something raised to a higher degree, a synthesis of all of his feelings about what was right and what was wrong about America. And he sought to do this in an operatic form. But he couldn't find the libretto. He couldn't find that subject upon which this work could be written. And I go into this in my book. I spend some time on this question because it's a very important question for American aesthetics, American political culture, and for Bernstein's life, of course. And that is that the audience for whom one composes had disappeared. Let me quote for you quickly enough, or I won't quote, but I'll certainly paraphrase from Goethe, the great German poet writing in the 19th century, that if one is going to write a national work, one must have an audience ready to respond. In our own time, Bernstein's own time, the idea had been that an opera must work or must come out of the great social forces that are afflicting the nation. Bernstein wanted to write that piece, could not find the libretto because the audience had disappeared. The American electorate had been moving to the right ever since the New Deal, and the right sometimes, that movement would sometimes be slow, but sometimes fast, but definitely a move to the right, and definitely for progressives like Bernstein, something to be deplored. And he wanted to bring that public back to its senses. Again, it could not find that work.
And was that a failing, really, of his allowing his music and his work to get too caught up in the politics?
I think that it was. I think that he had a great. He had searched for this libretto. He wanted to write this piece, but of course he was writing a lot of other things as well. But Songfest, I think, when he wrote when he did the opera A Quiet Place, it was an attempt to raise issues about homophobia, about family strife, in which parents look upon their homosexual children with disdain. I think that was a guiding theme, but I think that the larger themes he searched for and couldn't find. But he wrote songs after A Quiet Place in 1983. He did the opera Dybbuk with George Robbins again. But he was doing a lot of conducting, and for him, the conducting of Gustav Mahler became the way in which he was able to express his the concerns he couldn't express in his compositions. And by that I mean that for him, for Mahler, for Mahler, and as Bernstein understood him, Mahler had been the victim of the harbinger of the catastrophes that befell European Jewry and Europeans in general that were about to happen in World War II. Mahler had died in 1911. Bernstein, in 1960, of course, having already championed Mahler's music, began to see in Mahler's music an expression of those catastrophes, an expression of the great tragedies that were cascading down through the age. And when he conducted Mahler, increasingly in the 60s and on, which is, became a specialty right until his death, it was as if this was the music that was expressing what Bernstein himself could not find in his composition. So I think that it was Mahler's music that stood as his way of getting to the audience. That is, that he would be the catalyst between composer and orchestra on the one hand and audience on the other. That was where Bernstein saw himself.
Who was Bernstein close to? Who had an influence on him in terms of his political thinking?
I think that it certainly early on when his political life was getting organized, when he was a college student, I would think that not only the situation with the rise of Nazism, as I mentioned earlier, abroad, and, of course, Father Coughlin and other anti-Semites at home, that was not only in itself important, but Roosevelt's election. He thought of Roosevelt, as so many did in those days, as virtual savior. And, of course, the New Deal became sanctified, mystified, so did the Popular Front, as the great moment that had passed, and we could not retrieve it. When he with Aaron Copland and others in those circles at the very same time, that helped forge his outlook. But I think that from then on, Bernstein was on his own. He influenced himself. I think that his musical hopes and aspirations to compose a great American work fell in with his feelings about social justice and social injustice. So I think that Bernstein was his own man when it came to that kind of outlook. I think that that's pretty much what I can say about it. That he has developed his own set of values. He was a very strong-willed person. And I think that it's what happened at the beginning of his career that set all the rest of this in motion.
Barry Sells. The book is Leonard Bernstein, The Political Life of an American Musician. It's just out from University of California Press. Barry, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
My absolute pleasure.